It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear from two friends with Madison Roots who founded their own small publishing press with the stated mission of creating queer comics for queer folks. First, Milwaukee was once considered one of the best cities in the country for African Americans, offering the possibility of good-paying industrial jobs and home ownership. Today, it's become known for being one of the most segregated cities in the country and having some of America's biggest disparities between black and white residents in household income, incarceration rates, and more. Our next guest says he and many other black people in Milwaukee are frustrated, and while city and county leaders have recognized the problems, progress has been tough to come by. James E. Causey is a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a 2019-20 Marquette University O'Brien Fellow. He's lived in and reported from the city for a long time. James, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, compare and contrast 50, 60 years ago in Milwaukee when you say, I think your parents moved to Milwaukee from Georgia to now.
Actually, they moved here from Mississippi.
Mississippi, I'm sorry.
To Milwaukee for employment opportunities. Milwaukee at the time offered, work in the factories and on assembly lines, a lot of welders and people like that, tanneries, the breweries. Everyone needed, they needed workers, and workers from the South, mostly African-Americans, helped fuel that workforce and helped with the growth that led to the city's boom in the 1970s.
Now, in your recent piece on this, you use the words of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer to kind of frame the situation today in Milwaukee. Over 50 years ago, she said black people were, quote, sick and tired of being sick and tired. I want to give a listen now to a clip of her speaking in Madison, Wisconsin, this, I think, in 1971.
And there's a lot of other young people throughout this country that has been beaten down. But I want you to know something in this audience today. A house divided against itself cannot stand. A nation divided against itself is on its way out. We are going to have to stand up and make demands that will make this country worthwhile.
Can you talk about why you looked back at her speeches when writing about the slow progress in Milwaukee today?
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer was relatable to, she was different than the other civil rights leader like Martin Luther King Jr. and a lot of the black ministers at that time. Fannie Lou Hamer was a sharecropper who worked from the time she was really able enough to really stand and talk and walk real good. And she was relatable because she was like from the people. People understood her. I mean, she got into the civil rights movement very late. I think she was like 44 years old when she's started to make a name for herself. But one thing about her that really stood out is that she was just so frank. She could talk to people in the ways that, like, Martin Luther King Jr. could not talk to people because he had to maintain this certain level. But she could reach people who they could not reach. And I think she's one of those people who, when you look back at history, she's one of those civil rights leaders who we should all know about, especially in our history books and especially in our school system.
One of the frustrations you talk about in the piece, though, is that some of the same concerns that she was talking about and even her predecessors are still coming up today. Can you talk about that sense of frustration at a lack of progress, maybe even backsliding?
Yeah, I mean, this city is like ground zero for a lot of the problems that are really facing the nation when it comes to the conditions of African Americans. You know, when you look at our conditions, we have one of the highest poverty rates for African-Americans, the economic and housing gaps between blacks and whites are among the widest in the country. Reading scores for African-American boys in the fourth and eighth grade compared to white boys in the same grade levels are among the widest in the nation. We have one of the widest wealth gaps between blacks and whites in this country. And, you know, you wonder, like, from like 1970, when this was considered one of the best places for African Americans to live, and raise a family compared to now is becoming one of the worst places to raise a black child, according to some studies. It makes you wonder what happened. You know, yeah, I understand we lost a lot of our manufacturing jobs. A lot of jobs moved overseas, took their work to the South, to non-union facilities and places like that. But other big cities suffered the same fate. Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago. But they were able to bounce back some. So why has Milwaukee, which is right on a lake, which should be a great generator for a lot of work and progress, why was Milwaukee so late to and still struggling to turn things around? That's where the frustration comes in, because we have more black leaders right now than ever before, but they're trying to fix a lot of problems that were not fixed before they came into office. And so it's frustration all across the board.
Talking to James Causey from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a Marquette University O'Brien Fellow, talking about a project he's working on, looking at disparities, racial disparities in Milwaukee, and looking at solutions and visions for the future. And James, let's turn to that now. You've got this project going on where you are inviting people from the community to try to envision, to look ahead into the future. What specifically are you asking for from people?
Oh, yeah. So great question. So one thing that makes this project different is that I'm not going to rehash all the problems that we already know about. We know about some of the things I already stated. One thing I want to look for, what I'm looking at, is like the best practices in other states and other cities, and right here in Milwaukee, that may need like additional funding, mentors, or whatever it needs to in order to be successful. But one thing that I thought was important is like, what is the vision for this city? You know, I don't think it's been really articulated well by our politicians and the people in positions. So what I'm asking for is for the public to create a vision board and think about what you want this city to look like a year from now, you know, and don't focus so much on the problems, but what does success look like for this city? For instance, if you say, you know, you want better police community relations, then on your vision board, you wouldn't put a picture of a police officer, like, you know, harassing someone of color. What you would do is show what that success looks like. Maybe is a police officer in charge of a block watch or something to that effect. So what you want to do is focus on what you think the problems are now, but what does solution, what does a great city look like? And what I want to do is, when I collect these vision boards, I want to invite our public leaders to have a look at them and see what if their vision matches up to the visions of the citizens of the city. So basically, over the next 3 to 4 weeks, I want people to submit their vision boards to me. Actually, over the next 2 weeks, submit their vision boards to me. You could do it on a 20 by 22 sheet of paper. You could use words. You could cut out pictures. You could write on your vision board. But just what do you want this city to look like a year from now? Because we can't say we want progress unless we know what progress looks like. And so you can submit those vision boards to me, take a picture of it, explain your vision board in a short summary, and email me at jcausey@jrn.com.
And then you're going to take this, you say, to leaders in the community. And I think that might be elected officials, it might be community leaders and others. What are you hoping then they take out of these art projects, in effect, envisioning the future of Milwaukee?
Well, what I'm hoping is that they could look at these vision boards and really see what people are saying. I mean, like, again, we know what the problems are, but wouldn't it be nice to know, like, what if there's a common theme that takes place? It would be nice if the mayor knew what that common theme was. It would be nice if the police chief knew what that common theme was, and the county executive, and the alder people. They need to know what people want the vision to be for this city, because, you know, I'm not sure what the mayor's vision is. I'm not sure what the sheriff's vision is. I'm not even sure what the police chief's vision is, because they never really articulated that very well. However, the public, they have a vision of what they believe the city should look like. And if they haven't, this gives you an opportunity to really sit down and think about it. So maybe I'm encouraging people to do it in groups and really just take the time and be as creative as you can in putting together these vision boards, because I think it opens doors to a lot of great conversation and things that we should be doing in this city.
We're talking to James Causey of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at persistent racial disparities in Milwaukee and asking for public input, artistic input in a way to try to envision what the city could be, to see what the potential is and how you can get there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in Milwaukee, what do you think when you hear this idea of envisioning a better future for the city? What would that look like to you? If you're a person of color in that community or nearby, what do you think of the job city leaders and others are doing to try to tackle these problems and to make a better future in the city? If you're looking at Milwaukee from the outside, what are your thoughts? What could the city bring to the state of Wisconsin in a better day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with James Causey of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about racial disparities in Milwaukee, why they've been persistent, and trying to create a better vision for the future of the city and ideas about how to get there from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in Milwaukee, if you used to live in Milwaukee, what do you think about the disparities when it comes to race in Milwaukee? If you're a person of color in Milwaukee or elsewhere, do you feel frustration at slow progress? The same questions coming up generation after generation. Do you see solutions to gaps when it comes to income, incarceration, and housing? Do you see programs that are making a difference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And James, in your writing on this, you say, you know, there have been ideas and there have been positive projects, but they fall short, a lack of funding sometimes, a lack of coordination or follow through. Can you talk about obstacles even when good ideas do come along?
Yeah, see, that's where a lot of the frustration lies. We tend to do this, like a great idea. Someone hears about a great idea in another city, or they hear about one here in the city of Milwaukee, and we say, okay, we need to do that. And so they hear about an idea. For instance, my idea to for the city to adopt a Cleveland Co-op program, which would create jobs here and really addresses getting people to work who are the hardest to get to work. When I wrote that piece like 3 years ago, the Milwaukee Common Council seemed like they were behind the idea. Everyone on the Common Council signed off on it. Alderman Bob Donovan actually held several meetings about it, and he tried to get people on board. And it failed because there was no money. I mean, for the simple reason they didn't have money to try to copy that idea. And it just seems like, okay, but you have money for all these other things. And, you know, people quit talking about it and it went away. And to me, that just seems like that just doesn't make sense, because, you know, we need to start thinking about the end game, because why we didn't go any further than just the planning stages for trying to copy the Cleveland plan. Cleveland, with their cooperative idea, they've expanded their program. It's over 250 workers working now that did not work before. They're forming new partnerships, and they're growing even more. So it's just like when you see the growth in other cities and you see what they're doing, and you look back at us and all we did was hold meetings and didn't go anywhere because we didn't have any funding, it makes you shake your head and think, well, what the hell are we going to do? Because what's the plan? I mean, I interviewed someone, Earl Ingram Jr., who's a radio talk show host here, and he's frustrated too. And he says, well, what is the jobs plan for this city? We don't have one. Or if we do, it hasn't been articulated to the people of this city. And I have to agree with that, because I don't know what the job plan is. I don't know what the safety plan is. Is the safety plan more cops? That just can't be the plan, because if that's the plan, you can't police yourself to a safe city, because there's no amount of police that could make your city any safer. So what is the plan? It hasn't been articulated. Our jobs plan hasn't been articulated. Our crime plan has not really been thoroughly articulated. And that's where the frustration lies. That's why people are protesting and saying, we need to defund the Milwaukee Police Department, because everywhere else is being, you know, the parks budget is being cut. The school budgets are being cut across the city and across the country. But one thing that never seems to get cut and always seems to get increased is the police budget. And the city is no safer today than it was like last year. We already have 94 homicides compared to 55 homicides last year right now. And it's just like, well, what's the plan? Because the city isn't any safer, and the Milwaukee Police Department wants a 6% increase in their budget just to maintain what they're doing right now. And that's why people are frustrated. It makes absolutely no sense. We have to change it up and do something different.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Waukesha. Dan, hello.
Hello there.
What do you want to bring up, Dan?
I used to live in Milwaukee many years ago, and back then there were a ton of manufacturing jobs for the asking. The vast majority of black families had those good-paying jobs and stable families. The main thing that's hurting Milwaukee was the loss of manufacturing jobs, and then you have all the other problems. They wanted to open a meatpacking plant in Milwaukee, but it was frowned upon. Those would have been family wage jobs. So you can't really, I don't think the city can be so picky, in my opinion, in this global economy. You know, it's terrible, all of the...
Gotcha, Dan. James, you actually wrote about all the things Dan talked about there and touched on that, the lack of manufacturing jobs, the loss of manufacturing jobs earlier. But you also write some cities have figured out, and you were referencing that Cleveland model, some cities have figured out ways to at least partly bounce back from that, and you say Milwaukee hasn't matched that.
Yeah, so, you know, if I could talk a little bit about the meatpacking plant that was scheduled to come here in Citrus City, which is actually just blocks away from where I live. You know, if it sounded like it was a decent idea, it was a promise at one time of 250 jobs, but when you look deeper into the numbers, it was never going to be 250 new jobs. It was going to be like a lot of the jobs were be transfer jobs from where the meatpacking plant was coming. So that it was never going to hit that 250 like we thought. It would have been more workers at that plant, and maybe that would have sparked other development of other things. But when you say that Milwaukee shouldn't be picky, I think it's a time where, yeah, we should be picky. I mean, you don't want just anything in some of these places, because I think our citizens deserve better. We waited long enough, and I think we should fight for the best opportunity. So sometimes you turn down things, but you hope for a better opportunity. However, we can't wait a long time. Something needs to happen right away.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to James Causey from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about problems facing Milwaukee and trying to create a vision for the future and a path to match that vision. Back to your calls. Joe is with us in Mosinee. Joe, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, the increase in the budget the police department's requesting of 6%, I don't think you should put the onus of the death rate in Milwaukee on the police department. You know, I don't think the two correlate. You got a problem with people killing one another, and the police department, they're not the mediators here. They're trying to do what they can.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. And James, I don't think you were saying the police caused the homicide rate in Milwaukee. I think you were saying there's more fundamental issues there that you'd like to see tackled. Do I have that right?
Yeah. No, I'm not criticizing the police department in that way. What I'm saying is that the police department is requesting a 6% increase in the budget just to maintain what they have right now, according to the mayor of this city. That means like it won't be no new police officers, no new anything. Just to maintain what they have right now, they need a 6% increase, which will bring their budget close to $300 million for the city. When the talk of defunding police comes up, it means like the police shouldn't be a catch-all for everything. Right now, the police department is a catch-all for everything. They deal with mental health issues. They deal with crime. They deal with homicide shootings. They deal with, you know, families arguing with neighbors across the street. You name it, they get calls all the time for that. what the defunding would be is taking some of that responsibility off the police department. So that money will come off of that and go into mental health and things like that, that the police are not really experts in, but that funding could go into mental health and let those experts deal with a lot of things that the police wouldn't have to deal with. And so it would just be reappropriating funds just to take pressure off the police department. Because right now, the main thing is they respond to everything. They're stressed out. They don't have enough officers. But you can never have enough officers to deal with a lot of problems of a large metropolitan city. And on the other hand, too, I will say this. I know you can't – when we say that the police are not responsible for the homicides, well, that may be true, but really a city is based off, you know, a lot of police use or data is based on the number of homicides. We talk about Chicago all the time and their homicides, and, you know, police get blamed for that because police don't want to see high homicide numbers. Nobody wants to see that. So they do kind of go hand in hand, unfortunately. And is it fair? I don't know if it's fair or not, but When there's fewer homicides, the police department kind of takes it. They like that. They like those numbers when they're lower.
In our last really just half a minute or so, James, I think sometimes people look at Milwaukee from inside and out, and maybe I feel a sense of hopelessness that the problems can't be fixed. In our last half a minute, do you feel hope?
I have to feel hope. I mean, I'm a citizen of this community, and if you know, too many people are, you either have to, like my father says, use the bathroom or get off the pot. So if you can't just stand on the sidelines and criticize. You have to be a part of this. And that's why this project encourages citizens and everybody to participate and be engaged, because no mayor, common council, or anybody could solve this by themselves. It takes citizens to be a part of that as well.
James, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thank you.
James Causey is a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about why the city's been slow to deal with disparities between white and black residents. You can find a link to his writing and his project, where he's inviting people to send in their vision boards. You can find out how to do that. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from the creators of a small publishing company working to highlight underrepresented voices in the comics world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, residents of northern Wisconsin joined a virtual public hearing last night to voice concerns or support of a proposed plan to reroute the Enbridge 5 pipeline. We'll learn more about the issue coming up. First, the world of comics has expanded far beyond the typical older superhero narratives or the pages of the Sunday paper. You can find comics about just about anything: mental health, marriage, war, travel, memoir. One small publishing company with Madison connections adds more to the genre, publishing what they call queer comics for queer folks. Kat Parra and Zora Gilbert are the founders of Margins Publishing, a small press publishing company focused on creating and distributing comics about and by marginalized creators. They met while attending the same high school in Madison. Kat, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Zora, thanks for being with us.
Hey there.
Kat, can you talk about the origin stories behind Margins Publishing?
Sure. So, like you mentioned, me and Zora met in high school, and then we just kind of went off to separate colleges for a little bit. But we still kind of kept connected and both have this really strong connection to comics, and, you know, had a lot of thoughts and feelings about queer representation in media, and kind of what we wanted to do with comics. And ultimately, we decided to put together this project called Dates, an Anthology of Queer Historical Fiction, and Margins is kind of what we put Dates under as a name. Essentially, Margins was because mm-hmm. of the desire to do Dates as a project.
And Zora, when you looked at the world of comics and graphic novels before, did you see not enough representation of groups, or bad representation, or a little of both?
I think there was a little of both, especially in the mainstream. One of the things that we were actually really inspired by was good representation on the margins. So there are a couple indie comic creators. Well, there's lots of indie comic creators, but a couple of them had gotten on Kickstarter and had had success with, you know, crowdfunded small press anthologies. And that was really inspiring to us. And we got really excited and just dove in.
And Kat, it might sound fun. Hey, I'm going to make a comic book. A lot of work goes into that. Can you take us through some of the kind of just the nuts and bolts of what goes into making a project like this?
Well, the biggest thing for a big group project like an anthology is definitely like bringing everybody together and kind of, you know, herding cats essentially, right? So we've had, you know, like 30 plus creators on the different, you know, on each of the different volumes. So that's a lot of like people to manage and like timelines to manage, because every single one of those comics, you know, you need to make the script, you need to do thumbnails, you need to pencil, ink, you know, toning, lettering to finally have that completed project, you know. And then once those are put together, even there's all of the, you know, wrapping it up into a book that is mostly something that Zora actually takes care of. They've become pretty amazing at doing all the pre-press stuff. So yeah, it's loads and loads of work for sure.
And Zora, can you tell us about the anthologies that Kat just mentioned? What we read, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. So Dates is an anthology of queer historical fiction. They're collections of short comics, up to 15 pages, by lots and lots of different creators, many of whom are fairly new to the industry. They've just started out. We've had some people in college who are just incredibly talented. The stories in Dates specifically all take place before 1965. They're all about queer characters, and there are no tragic endings, which was one of our mission statements going in, is we wanted these to be happy stories.
Yeah, Kat, talk about that, the importance of wanting happy endings in these.
Sure. So one of the things that we notice in like a lot of media, but particularly in stuff that's like in historical settings, is that if they do remember that queer characters exist, they kind of tend to shove them into these negative narratives of like, well, of course they're going to die tragically because, you know, queer people were never happy in the past because they're barely happy now, you know, and that's not true. Like, there's definitely examples that you can find in the past of queer people living, you know, successful and happy lives, even if maybe some stuff was, like, secret or, you know, you kind of have to keep stuff low-key, but, like, they found ways, they were successful, they were happy, and we wanted kind of a way to showcase that and to give people a chance to be creative and see themselves having, you know, or people like them kind of having thrived always as like a way of, you know, hope for the future, I guess.
I just wanted to mention that there's also a lot of Eurocentricity in our historical fiction that we have access to. And that Eurocentricity tends to cast queer identities in a really like fraught light. Whereas lots of other cultures have really rich histories of what we would consider queer identities in like incredibly normal situations. Like those are just part of being alive rather than on the margins.
We're talking to Zora Gilbert and Kat Parra, founders of Margins Publishing, with strong Wisconsin ties, talking about their work and issues of representation. And Kat, why is it important for marginalized people to be represented, you know, both in the comics themselves and among the creators?
I mean, if anything, it's definitely more important to be represented among the creators because there's been such little opportunity for people to tell their own stories and tell the stories that they're passionate about. And I think it's just, you know, we want our society to be reflected in the media that it creates, you know, and this is a great, big, you know, colorful world full of, you know, lots of people of color, lots of queer people, and those people need an opportunity to make their voices heard. And they really have been really stifled, I think, in comics specifically, which has been very white, very male, and, you know, very straight and cis. And so everyone deserves those opportunities.
And Zora, as the two of you go out and look for contributors, is it, you know, there's this groundswell of people who want to be on board, or are you going to having to go out and really seek them out?
So we've been lucky, and every time we've opened submissions, we've been overwhelmed by people. I think there's a real hunger to tell these stories and to be able to tell one's own story. Our editorial philosophy is really focused on the story that the creator wants to tell. And I think that's really appealing to people.
And Kat, can you talk a little bit about your love of the comic medium in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that something that's so fantastic about comics is that no two people are ever going to make the same comic. Everyone has their own artistic sensibilities that they bring to the visuals. Everyone has their own ideas that they bring to the writing. I mean, even if you had the same script, you would get a completely different comic from two different artists. And I think that's so unique, the way that more than anything, I think comics, you can really put your soul on the page. And just that combination of written and visual, I think is totally unique. You know, there's nothing like it. I'd love it to death.
And Zora, same question. If you have things you'd like to add to what Kat had to say.
I mean, Kat hit most of the points. I think that comics are really unique in how they meld the written and the visual, but also you get this because it's paneling rather than film, you get to really savor moments, and you can make specific panels and specific beats have such an impact. And that's very exciting.
And Kat, what kind of projects are in the works now for Margins?
We don't actually have a whole lot in the pipeline right now. I mean, we had kind of planned to sort of take a little bit of time away from doing Margins after we finished our big push for Dates Volume 3. and then everything that happened with, you know, the pandemic and everything, it hasn't been a great time to get stuff underway. So we don't currently have anything in the works, but I expect that within the next year, we may have another little project. We're kind of planning to do stuff a little bit smaller, a little bit quirkier, maybe. So yeah, keep an eye out for that.
And Zora, as we wrap up, for people out there who might be, you know, a member of a marginalized group, can you talk about the idea of doing what the two of you have done and kind of taking the production into your own hands?
It's great. It's really hard. I encourage people to, if they have a story they want to tell or they have a project that they want to do and like get people together to do it and to find a way to do it. We're always happy to talk to people and talk about our experiences and how to maybe apply those experiences to somebody else's idea. You can hit us up on Twitter at Margins Comics. But yeah, I absolutely seize it. Even if it's a small thing, doing it is the best way to learn how to do it. And the more people we have doing it, the better.
Zora, thanks a lot for joining us today. Oh, I'm sorry, Kat, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, just going to add, I think it's maybe never been a better time to try and do independent projects with Kickstarter and social media and the ability to reach your base. So yeah, absolutely go for it.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Kat Parra and Zora Gilbert, founders of Margins Publishing, a small press publishing company focused on creating and distributing comics about and by marginalized creators. You can check out their published titles at margins.press. Coming up, we'll learn about a public hearing on the Enbridge 5 pipeline in northern Wisconsin and what's going on in Michigan with that pipeline as well. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we take a look at fan culture and who gets to decide if you're fan enough. First, residents of northern Wisconsin voiced their opinions about a proposed plan to reroute the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline in a virtual public hearing last night. Many of the residents voiced their opposition to the plan, citing concerns over environmental contamination and climate change as a result of the ongoing use of fossil fuels. Backers of the plan say that rerouting the pipeline will help provide jobs in the region. Our next guest has been covering this issue and joins us now to talk about last night's public hearing and what could happen next. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, bring us up to before last night's hearing and remind us a little bit of the history of this Enbridge Line 5.
Yeah, sure. So Enbridge is proposing to reroute a roughly 40-mile segment of Line 5 outside of the Bad River Band reservation in Ashland and Iron counties. And they're doing that because last summer, the tribe filed a lawsuit against the company, and that was basically looking to shut down and remove the line from the tribe's reservation and the watershed itself. Which drains about 1,000 square miles along the shore of Lake Superior into Lake Superior and the Kokagon and Bad River sloughs, which is often called the Everglades of the North because it lies at the mouth of this watershed and it's basically 16,000 acres of internationally recognized wetlands, and there's just a lot of pristine water resources in the area that people have significant concerns about, as well as the climate change factor and threats to native communities that you referenced, Rob.
And what's the current status of Line 5? Is the, I believe it's oil and liquid natural gas, is that actually flowing now, or is that on hold while all this gets worked out?
Yeah, my understanding is that the pipeline is still carrying up to 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids each day from Superior to Sarnia, Ontario. And just yesterday, a Michigan judge ruled that Enbridge could restart operations in the Straits of Mackinac, which connect Lakes Michigan and Huron. Earlier, that judge had ordered Enbridge to shut down the pipeline there because Enbridge had reported some damage to an anchor support on one of the legs of the pipeline running across the lake bed there. So out of an abundance of caution, it was shut down for a while, but the judge ruled that it could restart one of those pipelines that's running across the lake bed.
And Danny, I know you've covered a lot of in-person public hearings over the years. First of all, set the stage for us, this virtual hearing. How did that work?
Well, like much else that's happened during the pandemic, everything's happening virtually, mostly through Zoom or other platforms. And so basically, there were about 360 people who had registered to provide input on a proposed waterways and wetlands permits that the DNR is considering for this project. And so, you know, the Department of Natural Resources basically gave some background about the project, what it would impact, where it would cover, and some of the things that they'll be considering as they review it. And one of the things that they have yet to do is conduct an environmental impact statement. So the hearing also took input on what that would cover.
So for people who voiced their concerns last night, and it sounds like that was a large portion of the people who testified, reading your reporting on this, Danny, what kind of concerns did they raise about the proposed new path for the pipeline?
Yeah, I would agree with you that, you know, the majority of people that spoke were opposed to the project. You know, they, as you mentioned, voiced concerns about transporting fossil fuels that contribute to climate change. You know, they highlighted more frequent intense storms that have occurred in the region in recent years, like floods in 2012 and 2016 and 2018 that have caused millions of dollars of damage across northern Wisconsin. And they also have drawn attention to how climate change can, you know, negatively impact tribal communities, which are more vulnerable to that because of their subsistence lifeways and their place-based nature. You know, the place where the Bad River Reservation sets on Lake Superior is part of their migration story. It's a place where the food grows on water or wild rice. And so it's not like they can just pick up and leave that part of their cultural heritage. And so they're very concerned about that, as well as, you know, the more than 180 water bodies that this pipeline relocation would cross if it were built.
Talking to Danielle Kading, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior, talking about the latest hearing on the Enbridge Line 5 oil and liquid natural gas pipeline in northern Wisconsin. Goes into Michigan as well, ultimately to Ontario. Danny, what have representatives of the company said about concerns, especially about safety concerns when people raise concerns about potential leakage into those waterways you were talking about?
Yeah, well, a lot of the concerns about leakage stems from, you know, the Kalamazoo River oil spill, which this month marks 10 years since that occurred. And that is one of the nation's largest inland oil spills. And it cost about $1.2 billion to clean up. It spilled about 1.2 million gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. And so people have had a lot of concerns about something of that magnitude happening here in Wisconsin. The company has said that since that time, they've invested billions of dollars in safety improvements and that they've been operating their pipelines with very few incidents since then. But, you know, opponents to this project also point to a million gallons of oil that have spilled on Line 5 across the land since the late 60s. So they're not convinced that this company can protect against every factor, especially when it comes to climate change and flooding in the area, because we've seen a lot of erosion and a lot of damage related to these storms. And even on the Bad River Reservation right now, that pipeline has experienced erosion where it's become exposed in parts, due in part to the weather that we've seen over the past several years. And so people are not confident that Enbridge can mitigate all the potential risks that could possibly occur with having a pipeline in a watershed like this.
You write that at least one labor group has spoken out in support of the pipeline plan. What kind of things are we hearing?
Yeah, there were several labor unions that spoke last night, and also some residents too who spoke in support of the in support of the project. And, you know, mostly they're citing that this is a vital energy link here in the region. It supplies, you know, more than 50% of the propane for Michigan and transports this oil to refineries across the Midwest. And that's all stuff that we use to fuel and heat our homes and our businesses. And they also cite that, you know, pipelines are safer than other methods like truck or rail to move that product. And for right now, as the country is still using this, you know, as part of our daily lives, that we might as well use the safest alternative rather than, you know, looking to truck or rail. You know, opponents say to that, well, you could just, you know, not build the project and leave it be. But, you know, I think the company says that oil has to go somewhere.
So there's this hearing, this virtual hearing last night. What are the next steps? What is the process now to get approval for this rerouted pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, it's lengthy. I don't think that we're going to see any kind of a movement in the next year or so, because there's still multiple permits that Enbridge has to obtain for this project. And they just recently received kind of more time from the Public Service Commission, which they have submitted an application to, because they're looking to acquire private land for this project. They want to take private land to build this pipeline. And so the PSC recently gave them more time to acquire the land that they have not yet been able to get voluntarily from landowners. And they're hoping to do that by the end of July, so that they can withdraw their application and avoid a public hearing or a contested case hearing that would involve gathering evidence as to whether or not this project is necessary and all the different factors that might be considered as far as like risks of a spill and things like that.
Now, this sounds like the kind of story that could end up in courts. Are there active court-related issues going on now, or does that wait until this gets approved and then, I don't know, people start filing lawsuits?
Yeah, there's several lawsuits in court right now. So it's definitely being challenged on dual legal fronts. I mean, Bad River has filed their federal lawsuit against Enbridge. And then you have the state of Michigan that has filed a lawsuit against Enbridge as well, because they want to shut down Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac. And, you know, one of the things that some of the people who spoke last night have said is that you can't divorce these two issues, really, that what happens in Michigan and what happens in northern Wisconsin are directly connected, and that we need to be taking a look at a cumulative or holistic approach of how pipelines that cross the Great Lakes can impact water resources as significant as the Great Lakes.
Is there another hearing planned now, Danny, that the public can participate in, or does it now kind of go for review to the DNR?
It will be reviewed by the DNR. There's a public comment period that ends, I believe, on July 11th, if I'm not mistaken. And as I said, the PSC, you know, unless Enbridge withdraws their application, will be moving forward with will likely be moving forward with a contested case hearing, unless Enbridge is able to, you know, obtain voluntary acquisition of that land.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, for having me.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. She joined us today to talk about what's happening with the proposed plan to reroute the Enbridge Line 5 oil and liquid natural gas pipeline that runs through northern Wisconsin and northern Michigan, and the public opinion surrounding that project. As you heard, there was a virtual public hearing for the DNR on that project yesterday. If you were there, let us know. Let us know how it went virtually and what you had to say about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Bad news, the Wisconsin State Fair was canceled a while back, but good news, you can still get State Fair cream puffs. Yes, the actual cream puffs that you can usually only get once a year at the State Fair. There will be a few different ways to get them, according to information on the State Fair website. You can get them as a curbside pickup at the State Fairgrounds in West Allis next month in 3-packs or 6-packs, plus there will be brownie and chocolate chip cookie options. They'll have a website for pre-orders. You can just show up, grab and go, and eat. Option two, apparently for the first time ever, the State Fair cream puffs are going on the road. The fair has teamed up with Festival Foods. Next month, they will have apparently cream puff sales at their locations in Verona, Kenosha, and Appleton. And if you are in business and you're looking to reward your employers or customers or your talk show team, say, with cream puffs, you can order them in quantity through the corporate cream puff program. Now, don't rush out to your car right now to try to buy them. This doesn't happen until August. Check online at the State Fair website for more details. But don't worry, it's all healthy because you can also sign up there for a virtual 5K run as part of a fundraiser for the State Fair Park Foundation. Registration includes a 3-pack of cream puffs. Maybe eat those after the run instead of before or during. Cream puff news you can use. This is Central Time.